In Australia, the country's government has signed a pact with its Pacific neighbors, declaring climate change the single biggest threat to the region and reaffirming the country's commitment to the Paris Agreement. But Australia is just one of many developed nations where a political shift to the right has slowed down efforts to address climate change. Robinson Meyer is staff writer with The Atlantic, who has reported widely on the movement. Rob, the U.S. is one of those countries that has pulled back on environmental protections in a big way. Are President Trump's policies having an effect on what's happening in other wealthy, developed countries?
I think we are seeing a Trump effect. It's a little different in each country, but what we are generally seeing is that Trump's environmental rollbacks are driving countries that want to take climate action to take less climate action than they may have once planned. And countries that are maybe more skeptical or have a history more similar to the United States in taking climate action are feeling that Trump pressure to pull back, and they're not being as ambitious, or there's just a lot of internal pressure on conservative parties to take more Trump-like stances.
And why is that? Donald Trump has felt a lot of international pushback from pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords. Yet at the same time, we're seeing other countries walk the same walk.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it depends a lot on the country. So in Canada, you know, Justin Trudeau campaigned in 2015 that he would, as prime minister, install a carbon price. And a carbon price is a very kind of fundamental classic climate change policy where you charge polluters for every ton of carbon dioxide or other heat-trapping gases that they release into the atmosphere. And so he was elected. He started to research that policy. And I think where the Trump effect has shown up in Canada is that the federal government, the policy it's going to impose, will be much less ambitious and much less costly for polluters than the one it initially hoped to.
Justin Trudeau is the head of, you know, what you could call a petrostate. There's a lot of oil in Canada. The United States buys a lot of that oil. Trudeau could make a major impact by making a major statement. Why is he choosing not to do that?
Well, because I think in this carbon price policy, what we see is that the American rollbacks on climate policy, coupled with Trump's trade policies, which are really straining certain Canadian industries like steelmaking or cement making, basically the Trudeau administration or the Trudeau government doesn't seem to think it can kind of double impose both a really ambitious climate policy and the kind of some effect of Trump's economic policies on certain Canadian heavy industries.
Explain that. Unpack that a little bit, because you wouldn't ordinarily think that the trade tariffs that Donald Trump is imposing would have an impact on how much Canada can try and cut greenhouse gases.
Well, so the steelmaking industry is really carbon intensive. It uses a lot of fossil fuels in order to produce steel. So if there's a carbon price, then its production will go up. At the same time, there are all these Trump administration policies on NAFTA, on a certain kind of industry-specific tariffs that basically benefit American steelmakers and disadvantage Canadian steelmakers. And the Trudeau government has seemed to conclude that the combination of those Trump policies and a fairly ambitious carbon price would just diminish Canadian competitiveness in steelmaking too much. And so they've said that Canadian steelmakers, at least in Ontario, will only be taxed on 10% of their emissions.
Let's look at what's happening in France. The environment minister suddenly departed from Emmanuel Macron's government there in France last week. Nicolas Hulot quit his job during a live radio interview last week, saying that he did not want to lie to himself anymore about how little progress the French government is making on environmental issues, including climate change. Wasn't the French government of Emmanuel Macron full throttle on reducing the threat of climate change in the beginning?
They have been full throttle on international diplomatic efforts around climate change, on speaking about the importance of climate change, certainly on supporting climate science. Their actual economic policy has maybe not been as speedy as Hulot, who comes from a very like environmental activist background, may have been hoping for.
You write about Australia, a country that, as you say, extreme weather has battered on all fronts. Carbon-warmed oceans are plundering, as you write, the Great Barrier Reef. Record-breaking drought is ravaging the country's well-populated southeast. And yet the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, has been ousted. And part of his downfall was apparently the fact that he supported cutting carbon emissions, even though the plan was not all that ambitious. How much of a factor was climate policy in his fall from grace?
I would say it was a significant factor, but it was very ultimately specific to the Australian political context, in that Australia has had six different prime ministers, I think, since 2007. At the same time, what made Turnbull unpopular and what drove opposition to him on his party's right was his climate change policy and the fact that he was about to legislate any of the emissions reductions that Australia had made under the Paris Agreement. That he was going to commit them to law made him so unpopular with the conservatives in his party that they threw him out of office.
When a country like Australia is seeing so much damage as a result of a changing climate, how could this be then?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, let me put it this way. I would describe Australia as having a fairly unique experience of climate change policy were it not for the United States.
What do you mean?
Australia is the only country in the world to introduce a very ambitious tax on carbon dioxide emissions and then 2 years later repeal it before the policy had even fully gone into effect. I think the closest analog there would be the United States, where the Obama administration set up a number of fairly aggressive regulatory policies on climate change. Unlike in Australia, they were not voted on by Congress, but now the Trump administration politicized them and is now repealing or watering down almost all of them.
You quote Tony Abbott, a former Australian prime minister, who has rejected many of the conclusions of mainstream climate science, which sounds familiar in this country. He says storms are not more severe, droughts are not more prolonged, floods are not greater, fires are not more intense than a century ago. And you say science says these claims are ranging from debatable to absolutely false. He's known, Tony Abbott is, for rejecting settled science. But are we hearing more of those claims questioning mainstream climate science elsewhere as well?
Around the world, yes, somewhat. You see that sometimes from Indian government officials. But it depends a lot on the country. And Australia has that history, like the United States, of having leaders, and Tony Abbott is one of them, who are much more willing to contradict or reject settled mainstream climate science. I think if you go back to Canada, it's interesting because even though the Conservative Party in Canada is campaigning very hard against Justin Trudeau's carbon price, and it seems like it will be a major issue in the national elections there next year, the Conservative Party leader is very clear that climate change is a huge issue in Canada and that he will be able to introduce some policy, which is not a carbon price, which will let Canada meet its Paris Agreement commitments anyway. I would say we're not quite seeing this global wave of Trumpian rejection of climate change, but he is kind of, especially in Anglophone countries where there's a powerful fossil fuel industry and there's a history of this, he has allowed it to kind of get some oxygen and come back into the light.
What's at stake here overall if the world doesn't meet emissions reduction goals, at least the ones that were set under the Paris Agreement?
Yeah, well, right now, not a single affluent developed country in the world is on track to meet its Paris target. The world promised under the Paris Agreement that it would not exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming, and the Paris targets taken together would not even let the world not warm by 2 degrees. So the Paris targets don't meet the 2 degree goal, and the countries of the world are not on track to meet the Paris targets. If that continues to be the case, if the world's countries don't decarbonize fast enough, then we're looking at longer droughts, more intense storms, larger forest fires, biomes across the world switching over from, you know, evergreen forest to deciduous forest, from deciduous forest to grassland. And I think most worrying for many people would be that it seems that if there's a certain amount of warming this century, we could get some really runaway sea level rise, where sea levels aren't rising by maybe a couple of feet by the end of the century, but they're rising by 4 or 5 feet from the end of the century, and it's totally unclear we'll be able to deal with that. So the stakes basically for human civilization, for anyone hoping to have an economically productive and peaceful next 80 years or next 100 years, couldn't be much higher.
You know, 80 to 100 years sounds closer and closer.
You know, it's funny because we always talk about what the temperature of the Earth will be in 2100. And 2100 has moved from this distant year, mm-hmm. kind of science fictional year, to like a year that most babies born today will be alive to see. And that's striking to think about.
Robinson Meyer, staff writer at The Atlantic, Thanks.
Thank you.
Civilization couldn't be higher in the next few decades. What do you think the government and what do you think individuals can do to lessen the threat of climate change? Tell us at hereandnow.org.